Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Today we're going to cover an issue which I think you're going to find very fascinating because there's been a lot of discussion these days about the microbiome, the intestinal microbes that can make or break your health. And we do so many things to damage our microbiome. We deny our kids breastfeeding. We fluoridate and chlorinate their water. We administer antibiotics very early. As adults, we take acid-blocking medication and consume corrosive foods, high sugary beverages, and all manner of junk that literally pollutes our gastrointestinal tracts and leaves them bereft of healthy bacteria. So lots of people are cramming in probiotics, and probiotics can help, but a more natural way to replete the intestinal tract is via fermented foods. Fermented foods, very, very ancient practice, is all the rage these days as people turn more and more to natural ways of repleting and balancing their microbiome. So today we've invited an expert on fermented foods. She has written articles and taught seminars on fermented and cultured foods. She has an article in Sound Consumer in March 2013 entitled Fermented and Cultured Foods, The Surprising Health Benefits. She is Cynthia Lehr. Cynthia is a versatile nutrition expert. She is currently assistant professor in the School of Nutrition and Exercise Science at Bastyr University, one of America's foremost naturopathic schools. She is also culinary curriculum director for their Bachelor of Science in Nutrition and Culinary Arts degree program. Boy, I wish when I was young I'd had some exposure to that, Cynthia, because that was certainly an interest of mine. I don't know, perhaps when I retire I can go back, live in out there in Seattle, and take some of your courses and learn how to be a better cook. She's written a cookbook, which is in its third edition now with more than 77,000 copies sold. It's called Feeding the Whole Family. Also, she's written Feeding the Young Athlete. And she has participated in more than 175 videos. She's featured in Cooking Outside the Box, a video series. And also, she's involved in public health. In 2010, she was hired by the Auburn, Washington School District under national grant to develop a curriculum to train food service workers in the practice of whole foods cooking. And hopefully, you know, all those tweets about bad food and cafeterias, that doesn't pertain to your school district because you've translated healthy nutritional guidelines, hopefully, into an appetizing form for school kids so that they don't scrape the food off their trays and leave it in the garbage.
Well, it's not that easy, but it's a good idea.
It requires ingenuity. We'll talk a little bit more about that, but our focus today is on fermented foods. So give us some background on this subject. What are we talking about here? People sometimes a little leery of food that's been allowed to sit for a while so that bacteria, perish the thought, is allowed to proliferate in the food.
Yes, and we have been doing this with all sorts of food for many, many centuries in human culture. And originally, of course, it was done to preserve food, because when the healthy bacteria outnumber the potential putrid bacteria, then the food is actually preserved. And you can keep things like cabbage for a very, very long time. Because
this is before the era of refrigeration, right?
Yeah. And it's only been recently that we've started studying who's living in those foods and why that might be a good idea to eat them. Before, it was just to preserve them. And also, of course, it was discovered that it changed the flavor radically to ferment or culture a food. And it was quite delicious. I'm not sure that they knew hundreds of years ago that they were actually changing some of the, the structural chemistry of the food and making it more digestible. Maybe they did. Maybe they could sense that. But that's another added benefit of.
Well, maybe the first fermentation was just sort of an accident, you know, when Og left his container of mash out for a little too long, and he said, "Oh darn, you know, that's all gone bad." And he took a sip of it, and he said, "Hmm, this isn't too bad," and maybe got a little high off it too.
Yeah, I'm sure if it was, yes, because wine and beer and all of those foods are fermented foods as well. Even kombucha has a touch of alcohol going in it, too. Yeah, you can get kind of a little tipsy.
Buzz off that. Yeah, we'll talk a little bit about kombucha, because that's all the rage these days. It's a fermented beverage, and we'll talk a little bit about that. But so what are some of the ways in which bacteria can actually help us?
Well, it's you know, this whole field of science is just every day. Actually, I subscribe to a newsletter that's called the Microbiota, or something like that. Anyway, I mean, the amount of research that's being done and that's coming out every day is fascinating and changing the way we look at things. And my current understanding of the way it works is we would like to think that, oh, I take a round of antibiotics and so all of a sudden my gut isn't working so well, and that may actually present itself as gut issues like gas and bloating or irregular stools or something like that. But also we know that it could also express itself as a depressed immune system, or you might start putting on more fat because hormones are regulated in the gut. We've also know now that mood is linked to the gut as well. So things like depression or chronic bad mood, that may also be about taking that long round of antibiotics. But what we kind of naively think is, oh, well, I'll just take some pills and have some miso soup, and then I'll get everybody back. And that's not really quite the way that it works. The situation in the gut is that all the bacteria have their own place. You know, you've got a full population down there, and I like to think of it like a tenement house. And some new bacteria comes in there, and it's more likely that the new bacteria that you put in there with the fermented foods or even taking a probiotic are going to help the neighborhood, but they're not necessarily going to move in. They might or they might not. So that's one thing that we're learning, that you can't just repopulate the housing structure by eating some yogurt tomorrow. You've done more damage than that, let's say.
Well, yeah, that's what I think some people think simplistically, even scientists used to think, well, all you need to do is just put a little bit, you know, take a teaspoon of yogurt after you've taken, ciprofloxacin or Levaquin, and it's going to put, you know, you just the few bacteria in there, they're just going to proliferate and explode and take over and replace all the damaged flora that was eliminated. And you make a good point there.
Yeah, that would be so wonderful if that was true, but it's just not. It's much more complicated than that. But nevertheless, of course, eating food that has been fermented or cultured is going to contain a wide variety of bacteria. One of the coolest things about it to me is that, say, I make some sauerkraut today, and in 3 or 4 days, it starts to get that kind of tangy, crowdy flavor. Well, there's certain bacteria at work that made that happen. And that crowd is going to continue to change in flavor for the next 2 weeks, even 2 months. And as it changes in flavor, you're getting a different group of bacteria, too. So when you're making that food at home, you're getting all this different all sorts of different folks, good folks, are coming to visit rather than just one or two that you would get by taking a pill.
Right. In probiotic, they sort of take often a laser-like approach, and they say, well, this is one species. We're going to use Lactobacillus acidophilus, certain subspecies such and such that's been well-studied and characterized, and we grow it in a big vat, and it's all standardized, and you're getting one thing, and they characterize the health benefits of that thing in isolation, like say it's good for your immune system, or it's good for constipation, or it's good for IBS. Is this the way nature works? As we populated our gastrointestinal tracts, we imbibed literally hundreds, perhaps thousands of different species of bacteria at a time.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And, of course, different foods give you different bacteria, too. So that's kind of awesome as well. That's why... You know, if somebody goes, oh, well, I just drink kombucha every day, you're like, cool. But, you know, there's more to it than that. There are more exciting and different folks to invite to the party.
Well, let's talk a little bit about kombucha, because actually this is not a brand new phenomenon, because I used to own a health food store in the 1980s and 1990s here in Manhattan, and a popular brew that was hitting the marketplace at that time and was all the rage was kombucha. You can spell it. And how did people spell that?
K-O-M-B-U-C-H-A.
Right. And it's a Japanese beverage. And it kind of looked weird when we used to sell it, because it looked like there was like sort of a little bit of a jellyfish floating inside of it. But that was like the bacterial colony that was literally floating inside this syrupy liquid. Is that the way it's presented these days?
Yes, but more and more so, to make kombucha, you start with kind of a sugared tea.
Mm-hmm.
And then you put the mother in there. And which
that's the culture.
It looks kind of like a jellyfish. And then the whole thing changes and it gets quite sort of sour.
Uh-huh.
Almost vinegary. And I find more and more nowadays the flavor that you buy, when you go to the store and you buy a bottle of kombucha, the flavor's getting, of course, because we're Americans.
Right.
The flavor's getting sweeter.
You got like raspberry kombucha.
Yeah, and it's much less. I mean, if you make it at home, I mean, it's really almost vinegary. I mean,
uh-huh.
You're getting quite a tart drink in your mouth that's going to start doing exciting things from the very moment it touches your tongue.
What are the purported health benefits of kombucha?
It depends on who brewed it and how carefully that was done.
Mm-hmm.
and was it pasteurized, because that's a problem.
Pasteurization is the enemy of live organisms. In fact, that's fermentation kind of went downhill after 1875 or so, when Louis Pasteur suddenly announced the germ theory, the theory that germs were the culprit in terms of health problems.
Right.
Everything got boiled, milk got boiled, and a wide variety of products that we now consume are dead products. You know, our pickles are pasteurized, many of them. They're not live. They used to be fermented. They're fermented to a certain point, then they stop the fermentation and freeze it, and then, freeze the fermentation, not literally freeze it, but stop it dead with either a heat pasteurization or a chemical pasteurization, so you got no live organisms anymore.
Right. But you can still buy pickles that aren't pasteurized.
And I do.
You have to look pretty good to find those. But I actually prefer to make and teach and eat food rather than using a caloric drink to get my bacteria. So I have made kombucha, and it's very interesting and lovely, but I tend to like to work with tempeh and sourdough and krauts and something where I'm actually eating it, because I think that's
it's a more natural that way. And yeah. I have to say, you know, I was early on in the macrobiotic movement, an adherent, you know, way before it was really fashionable in the 70s. And in those days, now you can just go to the store and buy tempeh. But in those days, you couldn't buy tempeh. You would buy a tempeh starter, and you would cook some beans, and you'd spread the tempeh starter on the beans. I know you're familiar with this process, but I'm just laying it out for our listeners. And put it in an incubator. In my case, it was an oven with a light bulb, like a 100-watt light bulb, which created a temperature of whatever, you know, 99 point whatever, the right temperature to make the starter grow. And then a magical process would occur. This thing that looked basically like a pile of beans would turn into a solid mass that was interlaced with these tiny, almost microscopic fur-like tendrils, which are the mycelia, which are basically, it's mold. It's a moldy bean dish, but it transforms the beans, and it's a live culture, and it's delicious.
Yeah. And one of the things that I find the most fun is that we have a lot of people that have food allergies now, and there's a lot of reasons behind that. But some of the things that they feel or they read about and think that they are allergic to are wheat and dairy and soy. And the interesting thing is when you look at how those three foods, and by wheat I mean bread, how those foods were originally concocted, they were done with fermentation and a lot of time. And when you do that with wheat, dairy, and soy, it changes their composition so much that they're actually very easy to digest and don't cause the kind of alert, for some people, I'm not talking about a celiac disease person, but for some people, would not then cause those digestive problems. And if you look at something like dairy, and you look back, and we didn't used to drink gallons of homogenized pasteurized milk, especially as adults. What they did, of course, then, like I was saying at the beginning, it was a storage problem, but it figured out how to culture the dairy so that it would keep. And in doing so, they made it way, way more digestible, because when you culture dairy, you change the lactose and you change the casein, which are the milk sugar and the protein that cause digestive problems.
The bacteria actually transform it. They sort of have almost a digestive capability to break down the compounds into simpler, more digestible molecules.
Right. It's wonderful. It's so exciting to me. So, and I perhaps we could also just kind of clear up for a second that the way that that I describe it in my class, the difference between a fermented food and a cultured food, is a fermented food uses usually salt and thyme and nothing else in order to create its flavor and bacteria, whereas a
cultured an example of which would be what?
Sauerkraut.
Okay.
Yeah. Or even sourdough. But a cultured food, you actually inoculate the food with a pre-existing culture. So that would be like kombucha, you put the mother in, or yogurt, you're going to put some of your other yogurt in, or like you were talking about the tempeh, where you actually inoculate it with Rhizopus oleosporus, and then it does its magic.
That's a mouthful. And Rhizopus
oleosporus. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. But it's an ancient culture that the Japanese seem to be particularly adept at identifying and domesticating these fermenting agents, and you know, making them safe, reliable, and tasty, and having the right properties.
Right, right. And digestible, which is so important. We forget that the route to digesting your food isn't a couple of Tums afterwards.
Right, or Prilosec, even worse, and then you can eat whatever you want.
Yeah, even worse,
right. Well, okay, so let's clear up some...
We're just so lost about that.
Let's clear up, so, you know, a concern that a lot of people have is, you know, this is bacteria. And can cultured vegetables give you a digestive disorder? I mean, the stuff sits on a counter at room temperature and, you know, it's got, you know, frankly, it's got all manner of bacteria on it. It's proliferating and it's bubbling. And can you develop a serious digestive disorder? Can you get botulism, for example, because that's a terrible disease that develops because of bacteria in food?
Right. It's actually very unlikely if you're fermenting food at home that that's going to happen. And the reason is that you are watching it and that you recognize when your good bacteria have not been able to proliferate, which only happens if you make several mistakes while you're creating your food. So, I mean,
What are some of these rookie mistakes that you might make that could lead to danger?
Okay, so for example, the when you're making a kraut, typically what needs to happen is that you mush it down so that that cabbage releases its liquid, and then the liquid needs to, the actual vegetables need to be submerged beneath the liquid. And that's part of what protects them. So let's say you didn't do that at all, and some mold grew on top, and it didn't really ferment. You could probably retrieve it by scooping off the top layer and then punching, you know, really, really smushing that cabbage
right
down so that the liquid did rise above.
So if it's red, green, or black, you know, fuzz on top, that's not what you want to consume necessarily.
Right. So, and your nose is a pretty good indication. So if it smells putrid, of course, that's not something that you want to eat.
Because we're generally equipped with the olfactory instincts,
yeah,
to help us avoid rotten food, right?
Exactly. So the food lets you know. And, of course, the color that comes to mind first to me are the ones you mentioned, are gray or pink. But even so, lots of people, you know, if they neglect something and something like that happens, they'll just, you know, get rid of that top layer where that happened and move on.
Mm-hmm.
I think if dairy putrefies you, you really know the smell of that, though. And because it's not sour anymore. It's really a sickening kind of flat taste and smell. So. You know, because it tells you. Whereas, you know, if you've got E. coli on some lettuce, you're not going to have any idea.
Right. That would be an invisible pathogen, you know, or what gets chopped up in a hamburger that so often sickens people, or the stuff that's in chicken if you don't cook it at high enough temperature till it's no longer pink.
Right. There's a wonderful story in Michael Pollan's most recent tome called Cooked, where he talks about this, I believe it was a nun who was making her own cheese and in these wooden vats, and the health department said, oh my God, this is terrible. And this woman actually got the diocese or someone to, I'm probably telling this story very badly, but go back and help her pay to get her PhD in microbacteria, and she eventually took everything in and had it analyzed and found out that there was absolutely nothing harmful at all in the cheese that she was making in these old wooden vats compared to, let's say, something done in a factory setting where there was stainless steel, and those cheeses actually turned out to have more potential for something harmful than hers.
Well, that's amazing.
I did a pretty bad job of telling that story,
no,
but it's beautifully written in the book.
You convey the idea, and people can find out more about it in reading Michael Pollan's latest book. All right, so we generally divide these podcasts into two parts. So what we'll do is let's conclude part one on this note. We've introduced the idea of fermented and cultured foods. And in part two, we'll discuss particulars. So you can begin to add the benefits of these types of products to your your diet, either via products that you can get at the health food store, now also in major supermarkets, although to a lesser degree, or better yet, start your own fermentation process at home, because that's even better. That's fresher and offers you a wider spectrum of beneficial bacteria. Our guest is Cynthia Lehr, and she is a nutrition expert currently lecturing at Bastyr College of Naturopathic Medicine in Seattle, Washington. Part two coming up in just a minute. I hope you'll stay with us. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.